This episode of Food Psych is brought to you by my Intuitive Eating Fundamentals online course. If you're ready to break free from diet culture and reclaim the life it stole from you, learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, which is available now, and The Wellness Trap, which will be out in early 2023. And by the way, on this show, I avoid saying diet culture stuff like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome to this episode of Food Psych. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and today I'm going to be answering an audience question about how processed foods and the food environment interact with intuitive eating. I answered this question on the podcast before, years ago, but I wanted to circle back to it now because diet season is upon us, and I feel like a lot of questions about processed food come up around this time of year. Before I get into all that, just a few quick announcements. This episode of Food Psych is brought to you by my Intuitive Eating Fundamentals online course, which is a 3-month immersion in intuitive eating with dozens of hours of content helping you learn this anti-diet approach, troubleshoot common sticking points, and get to a place of greater peace with food. It also has a huge library of Q&As from me and my team to help answer all the frequently and not so frequently asked questions that come up for you when you're learning or relearning intuitive eating. If you're ready to break free from diet culture and reclaim your right to a peaceful, easy relationship with food, learn more and sign up for the course at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. This episode is also brought to you by my first book, Anti-Diet, Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-Being, and Happiness Through Intuitive Eating, which is available wherever books are sold. It's a great companion to this podcast because it goes into depth about diet culture and the ways that it harms us, with hundreds of scientific references and resources to help you make the anti-diet case to the people in your life. It also lays out the foundation of intuitive eating and helps you start making peace with food in your body. And if you get the audiobook, you can hear me read it to you. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/book to order it now. That's ChristyHarrison.com/book. Now, without any further ado, let's get into this week's question. It's from Lori, who writes, "Hi, Christy. I'm a fellow eating disorders dietitian, and I'll be leading a discussion with my staff based on your podcast number 127, the first I've listened to, which I very much enjoyed. I have some thoughts that I didn't hear addressed and suspect will be raised by my staff, so I'm wondering if you can address them. Intuitive eating and the self-regulation that should result surely requires overcoming deprivation. I'm with you 200%. But someone whose diet is almost exclusively fast food, for instance, or largely highly processed foods, isn't intuitively shifting choices when factors beyond deprivation play a role. Think of Brian Wansink's research and impact on how foods are presented, sensory triggers, etc. Why don't you, as a dietitian and health advisor, direct individuals to shift food selection without a black and white approach, of course, or shame regarding these choices? It seems to me from the work I've done that discussion of hunger awareness, as well as the role of other triggers to eating, needs to be addressed to start the discussion of internal versus external cues to self-regulation. Looking forward to your thoughts." So thanks, Lori, for that great question. And before I answer, I'll just give my standard disclaimer that these answers and this podcast in general are for informational and educational purposes only, aren't a substitute for individual medical or mental health advice, and don't constitute a provider-patient relationship. Also, this is just my take as one dietitian and journalist, and I hope you'll seek out other perspectives and consult your own inner compass as well. So this is a great question, and I can definitely see why you or your staff would wonder about it. First, I want to discuss what the science actually says about processed foods and our ability to self-regulate around them. And then I want to talk about why we're so quick to believe the worst about our food environment and why I, as a dietitian and journalist reporting in this space, don't tell people how to shift how they eat, even in a very non-black and white and non-shaming way, and why this culture makes it really tough to have those kinds of conversations without evoking shame. So first, we'll talk about the science. A few years ago, there was a really interesting review of the scientific research on how restrained eating, also known as chronic dieting, affects food consumption. And this review found that not only do chronic dieters tend to eat more in response to food-related advertisements and large portion sizes, but they also eat more of both high-fat foods and foods that are labeled as quote-unquote healthy or quote-unquote low-calorie, even if those labels are actually false. So in other words, chronic dieters are highly susceptible to both food industry and diet industry marketing. Non-dieters or unrestrained eaters, in contrast, aren't swayed by food advertising or portion sizes in that way. They tend to eat similar amounts no matter the context because they're driven by internal rather than external cues. And what's more, when people are deprived of particular foods, they tend to develop outsized cravings for those foods. In Anti-Diet, I reported on a randomized controlled trial showing that women who were deprived of chocolate for a week had more cravings for chocolate and ate more chocolatey foods when the study period ended than those who weren't deprived. And this response to deprivation was significantly stronger among the restrained eaters, aka chronic dieters, in this group. What's more, the restrained eaters also reported more frequent food cravings in general than did the unrestrained eaters. Of course, there's nothing wrong with food cravings in and of themselves, right? But it's just interesting how dieting and deprivation can trigger them. So what I take from all that research is that the food environment doesn't seem to affect unrestrained eaters the way it does chronic dieters or people who are deprived of food. In other words, maybe the deprivation is really the driving force here, rather than the abundance of delicious processed foods in large portion sizes or the way those foods are advertised. You may have heard a different story about food cues because of Brian Wansink's research, right? For anyone not familiar with him, Brian Wansink is a researcher who is largely responsible for the widespread belief that people eat more in response to larger portion sizes and cues from their food environment. He did a bunch of buzzy studies that got a lot of media attention over the past couple decades, and his studies have been cited more than 20,000 times in scientific journals and books. But Wansink's research has subsequently been discredited. Many of his studies were retracted by the journals they were published in, and numerous other journals had to issue corrections. Cornell University, where Wansink used to work, launched a year-long investigation and found that he, quote, committed academic misconduct in his research and scholarship, including misreporting of research data, problematic statistical techniques, failure to properly document and preserve research results, and inappropriate authorship, end quote. In 2018, he resigned in disgrace from his post at Cornell University. So we need to be very skeptical of any of Wansink's findings, as well as those of the researchers who worked with him at Cornell's Food and Brand Lab, many of whom colluded with him in his scientific misconduct. And better quality evidence shows that restrained eating and deprivation are likely the reason that some people might eat bigger quantities when presented with larger portion sizes or other cues from the food environment. When people are driven by external cues like diet culture rules, they're more likely to respond to other external cues like food availability or advertising and marketing. But when they're driven by internal cues, right, when they're intuitive eaters and not dieters, they're not as likely to be swayed by those messages from outside themselves. They don't need to be told to, quote unquote, make better choices, right? And they're not likely to listen to that outside advice anyway. Now, let's get into the why behind all of this. I think one of the reasons Wansink's research had so many people convinced is that it seemed to reinforce what diet culture has already told us and what it's already made us believe and fear, which is that our food environment is making us eat, quote unquote, too much of the, quote unquote, wrong types of foods, right? Diet culture demonizes our food environment as the latest culprit in making us, quote unquote, overeat and gain weight. And demonizing certain foods and ways of eating is a hallmark of diet culture. You know, in my definition of diet culture, it's the third pillar, along with lionizing supposedly healthy foods. Demonizing the food environment and quote unquote highly processed foods is also a convenient way for diet culture to deflect from the real culprit, which is itself, right? It's driving people towards responding to cues in the food environment in a way that they wouldn't do if diet culture and deprivation weren't present. And when we jump to blaming the food environment and the food industry for all of Western culture's ills, as so many people do these days, we're actually reinforcing the diet culture beliefs that drive people into disordered eating and eating disorders in the first place, and that make them lose trust in themselves and their relationship with their bodies, right? When we repeat diet culture's rhetoric without questioning it, we end up colluding with the diet mindset. And eating disorder professionals in particular, I think, need to be incredibly vigilant against these kinds of arguments and not simply repeat them, lest we reinforce the beliefs that are driving our clients' eating disorders. Now, all that being said, I will acknowledge that the 10th and last principle of intuitive eating is to use gentle nutrition awareness to help care for your body. So there's a place for nutrition in intuitive eating. And if someone is eating only fast food or convenience food, it's true they might not feel so great. And they might benefit from bringing some other kinds of foods into their life. To the extent that that's economically available to them, sometimes it's just not. And that could be part of gentle nutrition for them, perhaps. But gentle nutrition is the last principle of intuitive eating for a reason. And that is, people can't really engage with nutrition in a way that's outside of the diet culture paradigm until they do the work of breaking down the diet mentality, making peace with food, learning to honor their hunger, stopping restriction, all the other principles and approaches of intuitive eating, which, you know, to me is really the antidote to diet culture. In my view, the most important thing for putting people back in charge of their own food choices and helping them follow their own internal cues is to help them stop restrictive and restrained eating and break free from the diet mentality. So when I'm speaking to a large audience, like I am with this podcast or in my writing, I never jump to the gentle nutrition principle, right? Because it's the last principle for a reason. And the overwhelming majority of people that I'm talking to are in a place where they really need help with the earlier principles, especially breaking down the diet mentality and making peace with food. So working through all of those other principles really has to come before gentle nutrition if we're going to have a hope of it being gentle, right? And not being just another form of diet culture, another diet to beat ourselves up with. Another thing I think is important is that, you know, as I alluded to earlier, if someone's eating nothing but fast food and convenience foods, it may be due to poverty and the inability to spend time or money required to cook from scratch, right? Because even if someone can afford to buy the ingredients to cook, they also need the time to prepare them. And both time and money can be scarce for lower income people, right? Many of whom have to work multiple jobs and just don't have the time to be preparing meals from scratch whenever it's time to eat. You know, as someone who has a master's in public health nutrition and worked in more traditional public health settings for several years before doing the work I do now, I really have come to believe that the public health field needs to stop talking so much about food and weight and start focusing more on ending deprivation in all its forms, whether that's deprivation due to poverty and food insecurity, deprivation due to diet culture, or both. And in fact, there's compelling research showing that often it is both. There's a groundbreaking study in 2017 and a replication study from 2019 by Carolyn Becker and colleagues. And both of those studies found that food insecurity is associated with significant levels of disordered eating and clinically diagnosable eating disorders, and that the people with the greatest degree of food insecurity also had the highest levels of disordered eating, not just binge eating, which is what you might think, and they did have that, but also compensatory bulimic behaviors. Remember, these are people with the highest levels of food insecurity, and they're doing these compensatory behaviors. Right. The 2017 study also found that those with the highest levels of food insecurity reported the highest levels of internalized weight stigma. So this means that even if binge eating begins in response to the deprivation of food insecurity rather than the deprivation of dieting, which it definitely can, diet culture beliefs about body size can still come into play, even for people who are food insecure. So in other words, food insecurity and diet culture are not two separate silos. They're interconnected and they both are linked to disordered eating. Now, if I'm working with someone one-on-one and I know their history, I know, you know, what they're going through in terms of like a history of food insecurity, and I've worked with them through rejecting the diet mentality, overcoming deprivation, all the other principles of intuitive eating, then maybe at that point I will talk with them about food selection and, you know, how the foods they're eating are sitting with them or energizing them and how they might diversify their eating so that they're getting a range of foods beyond just fast and convenience foods. But that's usually a conversation for very far along in our work together, once people have really stepped outside of the diet culture paradigm and are no longer having, you know, negative reactions to any talk of nutrition or health or getting triggered into orthorexic behaviors. And that can take a very long time, and it really depends on the person. So I hope that helps give you a window into my thinking about these topics and into what I believe all eating disorder professionals and public health professionals would do well to consider when they're framing discussions about nutrition. And that is, you know, we need to make sure we're helping people reconnect with their own internal cues before we start throwing a bunch of nutrition information at them. And the evidence shows that when people are in touch with their internal cues, they're not as likely to be swayed by outside forces anyway. I talk more about all this in my first book, Anti-Diet, as well, so you can check that out for more. This is already kind of a long episode, and I will leave it there, but I hope that helps answer your question, Lori, and thanks again for asking. To submit your own question for a chance to have it answered either here or in my Food Psych Weekly newsletter or both, you can go to kristiharrison.com/questions. Thank you so much for listening. And if you found this podcast helpful, I'd be so grateful if you'd take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can see all the places to do that at kristiharrison.com/subscribe. This episode was brought to you by my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. If you're ready to break free from diet culture and make peace with food, learn more and sign up at kristiharrison.com/course. That's kristiharrison.com/course. For full show notes and a transcript of this episode, go to kristiharrison.com/305. And to get the transcript, just scroll down to the bottom of the page and enter your email address. Big thanks, as always, to our editor and sound engineer, Mike Lalonde, community and content associate, Vinci Chui, and administrative assistant, Julianne Watasek, for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and producer, Kristi Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.